analysis of black philosophy and black theology. I haven't been able to do that, and I want to explain why. I cannot supply, at this point in our history, the content of black philosophy that was requested. And this is due to the actual circumstance and peculiar history of black philosophy in Afro-American culture. The problem is this. We cannot ferret out the controlling categories or the inner logic of black philosophy because it is not a highly visible or substantial feature of black culture. Let me explain that in more detail by contrasting it with black theology. Whereas systems of black theology have been formulated, systems of black philosophy have not. When black churchmen wanted to reconstruct black theology, they could easily turn to the rich institutional and intellectual history of the black church as basic material for their work. But there is no comparable object that I can readily identify as black philosophy. One is hard-pressed to identify a distinct and concrete object which bears the label black philosophy. I simply ask you, where are the materials, the text, oral or written, that have been recognized or designated as black philosophy? Who are the individuals who are acknowledged to be black philosophers? Faced with this situation, one is tempted to conclude that there is, in fact, no black philosophy. I do not make that judgment, however. I am persuaded that there is an aspect of black culture that is appropriately designated as black philosophy, but it shares the predicament of the hero in Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Though flesh and blood, living and breathing, its existence and reality are ignored or not noticed. What I'm saying is because of this invisibility, it is simply impossible to execute a content analysis at this point which effectively addresses the question, what is black philosophy? Thus, any research on black philosophy at this point in our history should be conducted along two lines which I want to identify. One, we must first isolate concrete objects or bodies of thought that we are willing to label black philosophy and do a content analysis of those specific items. See, what I'm trying to say is this. We don't have the research materials at this point to do a generic analysis of black philosophy. What we need to do is to build up the specific instances that you want to label black philosophy, and once we have done that, we can look at all of those and see what common features there are. But that kind of research just isn't available at this point. We must first identify and isolate the specific black philosophy or philosophers and examine their content to see what common features are present, if any. And I'm saying in order to do this, we have to start back at one lower level, the level of concrete instances of black philosophy, if you think there are such items. Then the second level that should concern us in terms of our initial examination of black philosophy, and that is to focus on the cultural context and the causal factors that bear upon black philosophy status in our culture. And I regard that status to be this. Namely, it is a minority and a disvalued intellectual position. So part of what I want to do today is to show the factors that keep or make black philosophy a minority position, that make it invisible, that make it a disvalued intellectual point of view. Now let me indicate how I plan to execute this. I want to focus on what I regard as a primary expression of black philosophy, though it is not normally called that, namely, black religious humanism. I want to use this concrete body of material to illuminate the research patterns and the methodological apparatus that we will have to use, I want to argue, to reveal to us the larger body of black philosophy. Now, I know this sounds like a contradiction. I'm going to use black religious humanism as an example of talking about black philosophy. I'm aware of that apparent contradiction. I will attempt to show that it is an apparent contradiction only that can be clarified by a more precise definition of religion. In fact, I want to show that the understanding of religion which creates this apparent contradiction is one that we have to get rid of if we ever hope to make black philosophy visible to us. All right, now, the general purpose that I want to execute in this analysis can be reduced to some specific propositions that I'm going to defend. And these specific propositions comprise, as it were, a set of methodological principles or recommendations designed to reveal black philosophy. Let me identify what those propositions are. This is going to sound strange, but I'll say it twice. The most profitable cultural and intellectual region to track down black philosophy is the area of black religion, phenomenologically interpreted. I'll run through that again. The most profitable cultural and intellectual region to track down black philosophy is the area of black religion, and I'm emphasizing phenomenologically interpreted. What I'm packing into phenomenologically interpreted is this, and I'll explain this in more detail further in the paper. A phenomenological analysis of religion reduces it to salvation, to soteriology. Soteriology becomes the centering principle of religion, not theology or belief in or worship of deity. I'm saying that's the revised definition of religion that is required as part of our methodological apparatus to reveal the phenomenon of black philosophy. A second principle. Black philosophy is invisible because its major expression, black religious humanism, is also invisible. And black religious humanism is invisible because the semantics and research methods that control black religion are not effective grids for exposing the total dimensions of the black religious and intellectual history. I want to argue that we have a narrow and parochial methodology that in fact obscures and disguises crucial parts of the Afro-American religious experience. We have brought to our study of black religion a certain pre-understanding of religion on the one hand and a pre-understanding of philosophy on the other that when combined hide from our view cultural and intellectual objects like black humanism and black philosophy. More specifically, that understanding which equates religion and theism when coupled with a certain view of the evolution and function of philosophy in the West obstructs our vision of black philosophy at two critical points. First, those two factors are a false understanding of religion and inaccurate view of philosophy in the West lead us to search for black philosophy outside the arena of religion. I'm saying that's the only place where you find it. Thus, if we put those two together and let that be the apparatus for our investigation of religion, we are confining black philosophy to perpetual invisibility. There's a second feature. If you put those two things together, philosophy comes out as something alien to the black psyche. Philosophy comes out as something that is a white intrusion, an inappropriate white intrusion into the black thought pattern. I don't think that's true. All right, with this understanding of our purpose, let me begin and make the first and primary point that I want to establish. Namely, I want to show the presence of black religious humanism and black philosophy in our culture. It is there. Researchers in black religion characteristically narrow their focus to the history of the black church and its monolithic perspective of Christian theism. I am confident, however, that future research will confirm that there are two religious traditions in black culture: a mainstream tradition of Christian theism and a minority tradition of humanism or non-theism. Evidence internal to black Christian theism itself confirms the presence of this tradition, this religious tradition that is opposed to Christian theism and the biblical perspective. Unable to fit the fact of black oppression and slavery into normative Christian categories, and lacking confidence in God's love and concern for blacks, certain blacks refuse to honor or worship the divine. Though there can be little question about the actual presence of non-theism in the black past, it is very difficult to determine the actual extent of this radical religious perspective, as I'll attempt to show. But let me give you some evidence internal to black Christian theism which supports or expresses the existence of this point of view. First, I would like to call upon Daniel Alexander Payne. And I just want to read a portion of a longer passage here. The slaves are sensible of the oppression exercised by their masters, and they see these masters on the Lord's Day worshiping in his holy sanctuary. They hear their masters praying in their families, and they know that oppression and slavery are inconsistent with the Christian religion. Therefore, they scoff at religion itself. They scoff at religion itself, mock their masters, and distrust both the goodness and justice of God. I want to emphasize the next point. Yes, I have known them even to question his existence. I speak not of what others have told me, but what I have both seen and heard from the slaves themselves. I want to call your attention to another passage from the Reverend Charles C. Jones, no relation that I'm aware of, who is attempting to prepare Christian ministry missionaries for their work among the slaves. And he's trying to describe to them the points of view that they're going to encounter and for which they will have to provide answers, as it were, from the gospel. And he's talking about the missionary. He says, one will discover deism, skepticism, universalism, the various perversions of the gospel, and all the strong objections which he may perhaps have considered peculiar only to the cultivated mind, the rich scholarship, and profound intelligence of critics and philosophers. In addition to the testimony of Payne and Jones, other researchers such as Sterling Brown and John Lavelle call our attention to a musical literary genre, the slave secular, that also confirmed a non-theistic tradition in black religion. The secular is often called devil songs, ran counter to the spiritual, the musical embodiment of the black church and its theistic thought form. Rejecting the biblical promises and the God-centered theology that the spirituals have etched in our collective memory, the seculars ridiculed the God their fellow slaves worshiped and bombasted the eschatological and soteriological good news of the spirituals. In Lavelle's monumental work on the spirituals, it is important, for instance, to be reminded of the connection that he establishes between the spiritual and the secular. I think this is crucial. Though he makes the spirituals the womb for fundamental features of black literature and culture, he does not trace the origin of the secular back to the spiritual. Rather, the devil's songs and the spirituals are depicted as two different traditions existing side by side. Now, there are other materials that suggest the two-way movement between the spiritual and other varieties of slave music that again makes it difficult to plot the exact boundaries and religious constituency of the secular and the spiritual. In the first public collection of slave songs, we find several revealing statements about the rich variety of musical types and their continuing interrelation. Let me just call your attention to four of these. We must look among their non-religious songs for the purest specimens of Negro minstrelsy. It is remarkable that they have themselves transferred the best of these to the uses of their churches. I suppose on Mr. Wesley's principle that it is not right the devil should have all of the tunes. Then he goes on to say that these secular features still crop out somehow, even in the most solemn hymns, in spite of the best intentions of the poet and the artist. What I'm trying to suggest is that even the collectors of the first volume of spirituals indicate that the spirituals, the theistic incarnation of black religion, comprise only part of the black experience that was fashioned into song. As the fiddle songs, the devil songs, corn songs, jig tunes, and so forth, and what are common. But this, I'm reading from the people who were collecting the first spirituals. We have succeeded in obtaining only a very few, this source is the federal project on slave literature. Though they identify a number of different genres, they go on to say that they are only including a few songs that don't come into the so-called spiritual element. I want to read this last sentence. Our intercourse with the colored people has been chiefly through the work of the Freedmen's Commission. And this is the punchline, which deals with the serious and earnest side of the Negro character. Now, it is this last confession that identifies the most formidable obstacle to substantiating the actual extent of religious humanism or philosophy in black culture, namely the biased pattern of selectivity used to compile and transmit the black religious tradition. We must not forget the fact that the individuals who first recorded the spirituals were white, and most of them were ministers. And I think it's important to recognize the influence of these factors in determining both the genre and the number of songs recorded. As Bernard Katz perceptively concludes, the vast majority of the songs that were rescued from oblivion were the songs of the Sabbath, of church worship. The songs of the rest of the week would have to creep out of hiding during a time when fewer men of the cloth were around. Thus, it is very possible that a great body of songs of secular social comment, too difficult to disguise for white ears, stayed underground and would surface later in the blues and other forms. What I'm trying to suggest is this. These materials highlight the risk involved in extrapolating from the number of extant seculars to the actual range and importance of the theological perspective they represent. I'm saying because of the biased selectivity, we should not use the paucity of black seculars to reach the conclusion that they were not a significant or common part of traditional black religion. Right, let me go on to the next section, which has to do with trying to identify some of the methodological and semantic obstacles that keep black religious humanism and the larger body of black philosophy invisible. And here I want to identify some misunderstandings about the nature of religion and some faulty methodological principles. Let me specify what I think the appropriate methodological approach ought to be. Number one, Afro-American religion must be approached as a multifaceted phenomenon that comprises the full spectrum of theistic and non-theistic options. I'll run through that again. I'm saying whether we have confirmed this or not, our point of departure should be to approach Afro-American religion as if it is multifaceted, and as if it does comprise the full spectrum of theistic and non-theistic options. Let that be the method to determine, let that be the hypothesis to look at and decide its truth and falsehood. All right, now, let's look at some of the semantic consequences of taking that approach. First, we would have to abandon the common but question-begging usage that collapses religion into theism. I readily acknowledge that theism is the most prominent subclass of religion, but it is still only a particular form of religion. It does not comprise the whole shebang. Now let's look at some of the consequences of making of equating religion and theism in terms of their impact on black philosophy or black religious humanism. If religion and theism are equated, non-theism by definition is excluded as a religious perspective. That makes sense, doesn't it? Non-theistic positions will either be ignored or mistakenly assimilated into the general theistic camp. Secondly, if the advocate of black religious humanism does not challenge this equation of theism and religion, he provides grounds for the claim that religious humanism is not authentically black. See, what I'm saying is, once you equate religion and theism, and once you couple that with a certain understanding of the black consciousness, which I'm going to describe in a minute, non-theism gets defined as non-religious. It also gets defined as non-black, alien to the black perspective, and intrusion from white points of view. Let me give you a couple of statements of description of black consciousness which help to bring about that kind of argument. You're familiar with most of these, so I'll just read part of it. We black people are religious people. From the earliest time, we have acknowledged a supreme being. With the fullness of our physical bodies and emotions, we have unabashedly worshipped him with shouts of joy and tears of pain and anguish and so forth. Let me give you another reference. The question of existence in reference to God is not the real issue for blacks. This does not preclude the fact that many blacks are non-believers. This is often true. Of many older black intellectuals who are humanistically oriented and who are greatly influenced by the position of Augustus Comte. But the return to religion, often as blind faith in middle life, leads me to believe that religion is native to most blacks. Religion in some form or the other appears to be an Africanism. Now, let me be clear. I am not questioning the accuracy of these statements as a description of black theism. They are accurate statements of that point of view. What I am questioning is these descriptions as adequate and accurate indicators of black religion as a whole. See, what is being involved here is this kind of criticism. I am saying that it is an arrogant assumption that the black religious experience is somehow exhausted by the theistic experience. Black religion, to me, is larger than that. Let me go back and make a few comments about those two passages that I read. First, it should be obvious that the statements don't make any sense unless religion and theism are equated. That's the first point I'm going to make. Second, it should also be noted that theism is not simply advanced here as the majority viewpoint, but rather as the normative perspective and the yardstick by which one identifies the authentic black consciousness. To say that religion in some form or another appears to be an Africanism, to say that we black people are religious people, and then equate religion with theism, we're really saying we are theistic people. And therefore, if you come across blacks who don't endorse that point of view, what do you say about them? Where do they fit, as it were, into the community? Much more is at stake here.
They go to Florida State.
Go to Florida State. Much more is at stake here than a recommendation for an accurate terminology. I'm trying to suggest that both the case for black humanism as an authentic religious perspective and also a valid expression of the black religious tradition stands or falls on this seemingly innocuous issue about the connection between theism and religion. Mm-hmm. Right. Now, over against this view that collapses religion into theism, that is, a belief in and or worship of deity, I want to advance the position that soteriology is the centering principle of religion. The basic presupposition of religion is this. First, there is something fundamentally wrong with the human individual or species. Something fundamentally wrong. And religion then advances itself as the fundamental or indispensable corrective to this condition. What I'm saying is this. Religion is a corrective enterprise. In this sense, it is similar to medicine. The presupposition of medicine is that people get sick. If people came into the world, never became ill, then there would be no need for doctors. I'm saying the existence of religion is accenting that there's something fundamentally wrong with the individual or the species, and religion is designed to program to correct that. Now, there are a number of corrective enterprises, so it's necessary to see how religion differs from those. Education, to me, is a corrective enterprise. Education presupposes that we don't know something. And education is designed to correct that ignorance. Medicine is a corrective enterprise. Going to a health spa is a corrective enterprise. But there are two features to me that differentiate religion from other types of corrective activity. First, religion advances its corrective enterprise as the ultimate, as indispensable for highest human good or well-being. It's the one you can't do without. Now, any corrective enterprise that defines itself in that way, to me, is functioning as a religion. Second, religion institutionalizes its corrective. Now, there may be corrective enterprises which don't necessarily get institutionalized. All right, now let's look. If this understanding of religion is correct, several corollaries follow, and I want to identify some of them. First, if what I say is correct, then the doctrine of God, or theology, is in fact subordinate to soteriology. I'll run through that again. If that understanding of religion is right, soteriology is logically prior to theology. What I'm saying is this. God becomes important because of his or her connection with salvation. It is because we say that God is in some way the crucial or essential agent relative to our salvation that God becomes important and not superfluous. What I'm arguing is that soteriology is in fact logically prior to theology. Second, the institutional dimension that I identified forces us to distinguish between institutionalized and non-institutionalized soteriological perspectives. Now, that distinction is important for this reason.
Would you repeat that?
Yes. Now, I'm simply saying that we can look at institutionalized systems of soteriology and those which are non-institutionalized. What I have in mind is this. Black humanism, black philosophy, are non-institutionalized. There's no church connected with the black philosophy. We have a number of philosophies in the West, in Western thought, but there are no institutions connected with them. But there are institutions connected with religion. See, what I'm trying to get at is this. I'm trying to avoid arguing that in order for you to have a religious perspective, you have to have an institution that goes along with it. I'm saying you can have a sociological principle or theory, however you want to put it, that is not necessarily institutionalized. That to me generally is a basic difference between religion and philosophy. Religion often usually does get institutionalized, philosophy does not. Philosophy normally exists as an intellectual perspective, as a point of view. It's there, but not institutionalized. Should I run there? I don't.
Yeah, it's all right.
Okay.
Clear. All
right. Now, I want to argue that black philosophy, as well as the bulk of Western philosophy before the 20th century, black philosophy and Western philosophy both before the 20th century, can best be interpreted as non-institutionalized sociological systems. Now, I know this goes against the grain of what we've talked about with respect to philosophy, so I'm going to try to explain that. Philosophy can best be interpreted as a rival soteriological perspective. It advances itself against rival positions as a necessary corrective for human well-being. We tend to overlook this soteriological dimension of philosophy, I want to say, because of the inner logic of Western monotheism and Christocentrism. Western monotheism and Christocentrism lead to the ignoring of the soteriological dimension of philosophy. What I'm saying is this. If you have a monotheistic system or a Christocentric system, and soteriology or salvation is defined within that context, anything that's different from that could not be regarded as soteriology. Is that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, now to help explain this in more detail, I want to look at certain thinkers who are labeled philosophers rather than theologians. And I want to ask why that's the case. And I want to ask why their systems are called philosophy rather than theology or soteriology. For instance, why are Spinoza, Descartes, Plato, Aristotle labeled philosophers rather than theologians? Each is theistic. And each, I am confident I can show, is advancing a soteriology. For instance, why is Spinoza classified as a philosopher? Why? Because he departs from Jewish orthodoxy. Tell me some other reason. Likewise with Descartes in a Christian context. Let me do this in more detail. If you look at the understanding of philosophy in the West, I'm trying to say that the definition of philosophy has been molded by looking at it from a Western monotheistic and Christocentric perspective, rather than defining it as it were indigenously. Now, when you approach the definition of philosophy from a Western monotheistic or Christocentric perspective, these things turned out to be called philosophy, though they could just as well be called theology or soteriology. Let me listen. Non-Christian theistic soteriology are called philosophy. Let me run through that again. Non-Christian theistic soteriology. Some examples would be Plato and Aristotle. They are theistic, but they're non-Christian, and I'm saying they're soteriology, but we call them philosophy, not theology, because they aren't worshiping the one God. All right, secondly, there are some non-theistic soteriology, and I would define someone like David Hume in that context. That's called philosophy, though it could just either be called soteriology. All right, there are non-orthodox theistic systems. Spinoza in a Jewish context would be an example of that. Descartes in a Christian context. Now, what is it? What is non-orthodox about Descartes? Well, there are two things. Descartes is not Christocentric. He tried to do, as it were, soteriological system, a total system of thought without any Christocentric element. Second, he also tries to do it by ranking reason above revelation. And that's the other feature, it appears to me, that is used to define philosophy in the West. Those systems that rank reason above revelation, nature or science above supernature, nature above the Bible, that kind of ranking with regard to soteriological knowledge are all put into the class of philosophy. All right, then a sixth item. Those anti-religious perspectives, I should say alleged anti-religious perspectives, such as humanism or atheism, are also called philosophy. For instance, we talk about the philosophy of Marxism, but never the theology of Marxism or the religion of Marxism. Marxism to me is theistic. And I think it's just as easy to see it as a religion of Marxism as philosophy of Marxism. I got two other items that are used. Philosophy is also used to cover or to talk about two other kinds of categories. First, theological categories which have been divorced from their soteriological context. That is, when we talk about medieval philosophy, what are we saying? What we have done is to take concepts like God and Aquinas, but take them out of the soteriological context. We talk about them in terms of arguments for God's existence and so forth. But I'm saying that's a truncated Christocentric theological system. Likewise, a system where the original Christological or theological components have been removed, we also refer to as philosophy. For instance, in the context of Kierkegaard, the philosophy of Kierkegaard. When Kierkegaard is taught in a philosophy department, what do? They don't say anything about Christology. But it's a Christological point, which to me is the foundation for all that Kierkegaard is talking about. But philosophers read either R and so forth, and that's, I'm saying you divorce or take a truncated part of the theological or Christian thinker and treat it outside of the context. We use philosophy to refer to that. All right. Now, what is the point of all of this? The point of all of this is that our pre-understanding of philosophy is covered by the Judeo-Christian worldview, with the consequence that philosophy comes to be regarded as somehow anti-religious or as an antagonist to religion. And the consequence of that methodologically is to direct our attention outside the area of religion to look for expressions of black philosophy. Now see, I start off arguing you want to find black philosophy, you want to look for it in the larger definition of black religion. So if we have a definition of philosophy that leads us outside of that arena, then I'm saying we're operating on a principle that will keep black philosophy in the. One other thing. In seeking to define or describe black philosophy, it is crucial that we do not define philosophy in terms of its role and scope in the 20th century. The definition of philosophy that informs logical positivism and its offshoots cannot accommodate the actual history of philosophy in the West. More importantly for our concern, it has a chilling effect upon the development of a black philosophy because it negates a necessary category of any ethnic philosophy, namely the category of particularity. Particularity will not surface as a crucial or indispensable or appropriate category in the context of logical problems. If that's a point of any interest, I'll be happy to say a little more about that during the question period. All right, now, let me go to another section. In addition to the semantic and methodological factors that we've already identified, there are some other things that impact the status and extent of black philosophy in our culture. The most crucial one that I want to look at is a possible connection between social economic context and religious, philosophical, or theological content. The question I'm raising is this. Does the social, economic, political context of blacks, namely their oppression, have any impact upon the fact that philosophy is not a substantial feature in our culture? And I want to answer that question yes. I am saying the paucity of philosophy, as opposed to the paucity of preachers, is related to the fact that blacks have been an oppressed people throughout our culture. Now, I know that this is a very controversial hypothesis, and I recognize in advance that I cannot establish this with any supreme degree of confidence. What I'm trying to do is to advance a perspective, a point of view, and a hypothesis for us to look at, rather than a conclusion that I think can firmly be established. What I'm saying is this. Humanism emerges most frequently in a context that is antithetical to that which defines oppression and especially slavery. To put it in other terms, a context of oppression is more generally connected with the conceptual framework of theism than it is with humanism. Accordingly, the actual historic situation of blacks in America is more likely to spawn certain forms of theism than humanism, and therefore more forms of theology than philosophy. Now let me indicate some of the factors that have led me to advance this tentative hypothesis. First, the actual evolution of humanism seems to be associated with a firmly developed urbanized economy in contrast to an agricultural or pastoral one. Second, humanism more characteristically draws its disciples from the middle and upper socioeconomic strata rather than those near the bottom of the economic ladder. Third, the evolution of humanism in Greek culture under the aegis of the Sophists seems to confirm this hypothesis. Fourth, Gaylord Wilmore's invaluable treatment of the black church and its contribution to the radical wing of black thought and practice also supports this tentative conclusion about the social economic context for the evolution of black humanism. Wilmore identifies a de-Christianizing period when the religious impulse self-consciously locates itself outside the circle of black Christian faith. It is accidental that he identifies this secular, non-theistic tradition with the intellectual upper-level groups of blacks. Is it accidental that a similar social economic context seems to be the base for those black writers associated with the messenger and its radical criticism of the black church? This one has to do with the attachment of... Further piece of evidence. A more focused analysis of the contrast, between the spirituals and the blues, to me, supports this point. According to most interpreters, the blues and the spirituals reflect distinct theological perspectives and distinct social economic contexts. He says that black infidelity about the divine, as well as agnosticism and atheism, this is a quote, do not develop as the results of the findings of modern science, nor from the observation that nature is cruel and indifferent, but primarily because in the social situation, the black American finds himself hampered and restricted. Heretical ideas of God develop because in the social situation, the breaks seem to be against the Negro, and the black thinkers are unable to harmonize this fact with the God pictured by Christianity. Close quote. I'm saying, whether you encounter black humanism during the slave period or in more recent eras of oppression, it appears as a critic of black Christian theism, questioning the latter's capacity to make sense of the history of black oppression and to accommodate the prerequisites of a viable theology of liberation. What I'm saying is any correct assessment of black humanism or black philosophy has to look at it in terms of this genesis. Let me carry this point one step further. Black humanists and those humanists who trace their lineage to the Enlightenment or to the scientific revolution are akin in attacking the superstructure of theism. Both do that. But their criticisms develop from radically different social economic contexts. And for this reason, they pose the question of God in quite different ways. For instance, scientific humanism poses the problem of the divine in terms of the coherence between the natural and the supernatural world. This query often leads to the denial of the divine reality, namely a form of atheism. But black humanists raise an entirely different type of question. They raise the question about the divine reality because of the crimes of human history, not nature, but the crimes of human history. And this emerges frequently in the form, is God a white racist? A question that you don't find at all in scientific humanism. I'm trying to say they come from different contexts, and they look at humanism in quite different ways. The radical theological questions that black humanism raises grow out of the context of black oppression. They cannot be reduced to the protest of a brainwashed black who has been seduced by white Western secularism. They are not imported, as it were, from the outside. Thus, it would appear that those who attempt to connect black humanism with non-black sources, such as Kant, are still handcuffed by their equation of theism and religion. Having equated theism and religion, and having affirmed that blacks are spiritual people, substitute theism, non-theism, by definition, would have to come from outside the black community. All right. The final point I want to look at is this. Does black religious humanism help us to plot the probable future interaction of black philosophy on one hand and black theology and the black church on the other? And I think it does. To understand black humanism and through it, black philosophy, we must look at these points. First, black humanism must be interpreted as a specific strategy for liberation that issues in a particular theology or philosophy of liberation. For the black humanist, this dictates a specific theological method which then becomes part of the critical apparatus for assessing black Christian theism. What I'm trying to suggest is that I see black humanism and black Christian theism as having a common goal. They are both, to me, working in the context of liberation theology, though they have different worldviews, different theologies or philosophies as a rationale or foundation for the same place. Let me continue this probable interaction at another level. The agenda of black religious humanism, and I would also say black philosophy, does not call for the destruction of the black church. Neither does it involve an absolute disapproval of the practice of the black church past the present. I'm underscoring absolute. As with this interpretive approach to black religion, black humanism endorses a pluralistic program for the mechanics of liberation. Though black humanism regards the black church as a sleeping giant in terms of its potential as a liberating force, it also recognizes that the history of the black church is checkered relative to liberation. And further, that the black church has never successfully corralled the majority of blacks in its congregation. For these reasons, black humanism thinks it is unwise for the fate of black liberation to depend upon whether the black church awakens from its slumber or continues to snore, however piously and rhythmically. The emergence of black humanism as a formidable opponent may well prod the black church, as other secular movements have done, to be about its father and its mother's work. All that has been discussed thus far has been an attempt to make us aware of a competing, albeit minority, tradition in black religion. And all that has been said here is simply a plea for a non-pluralistic approach. Excuse me. All that has been said here is simply a plea for a more pluralistic
approach. All right.
That's a key.
Yeah,
sir, I think
I'm right. That's
right. No, a more pluralistic approach to the study of black religion. Because the black church is the major institutional expression of black religion, one can readily acknowledge that its thought and practice should receive preeminent attention. Having said this, however, it must also be allowed that our concern to uncover the rich past of the majority position should not obscure the full content and scope of black religion. Nor should the effort to honor the black church and its particular theological tradition obliterate the total spectrum of competing theses of black religion, especially the non-theistic perspective. I simply say, we should not expect, nor should we hope, that the religious experience and outlook of some of us will be the theological diary or religious biography for all of us. Differences, both theological and experiential, will continue to surface. And we do well to regard the counsel of Hosea Ballou when they do. He said, if we disagree in brotherly love, no other agreement is necessary. But if we do not, no other agreement will do us any good. Thank you.
Thank you. strengthen the awareness of the status of the discipline, to call into question previous conception of that status, what particular emphasis it serves, what particular framework is being employed, and so on. I think this goes on in other disciplines as well. Black history goes on, black psychology goes on, and black theology. Black historians begin to talk about the importance of oral tradition, begin to talk about the importance of the written tradition of the downtrodden, which automatically calls into question the framework of when which history has been done. The same with black psychology. If the white, if the domain of white behavior no longer becomes the norm and any other evidence that emanates out of other domains become abnormal and pathological. And black theology, of course, we don't need to go into questions the privileged position of the social experience of oppressors as a starting point for theological reflection. Therefore, black, raising the question, what is black philosophy, leads us into metaphilosophical reflection. Philosophical reflection is about the status of philosophy itself. What I'd like to do in responding to Professor Jones' great philosophy paper is to talk about, or is put forward a set of questions and queries generated by the paper under two basic rubrics. First would be metaphilosophy, and the second is what Professor Jones understands the major expression of black philosophy. Name the fact that it is humanism. I won't go into too much about socioeconomic content and theological context and theological content. I have a word to say about it, but I won't talk about it that much. First, metaphilosophy. As Professor Jones notes, philosophy must indeed be viewed as an aspect of culture. Hence, an historical account of its status is necessary and appropriate. Of course, this raises a very crucial question as to what philosophy is itself. I don't want to go into that now. But a historical account would want to raise the question of what philosophy is itself. And indeed, once we understand how it's been understood under different historical circumstances, we may be able to begin to plug into what black philosophy is. What I want to do now is focus on the latter question, what black philosophy. I want to claim that when we ask, what is black philosophy, the background question is, what is black culture, if indeed philosophy is a particular aspect of culture? And if we indeed historically situated that way, that means that we have to look at this African-American experience, the complex process of cross-fertilization of which we are part of. It seems to me that it's no accident that we are hard-pressed to find an isolated tradition or even a stream of thought, of philosophical reflection, of Afro-Americans. And this is not only because of the talk that Professor Jones engaged in about the socioeconomic context and theological or philosophical content. That is to say, it's not only because of black oppression that we're hard-pressed to find an isolated stream of philosophical reflection. More importantly, because philosophy is not considered a separate mode of inquiry for either the African or the American. When we look for an African-American one, we are indeed going to be hard-pressed. I would want to claim that. In the African context, philosophy is not separate from religion. In the American context, it's a vehicle for cultural criticism, social commentary, societal reform. It's very important to note that America does not produce an indigenous philosophy until the beginning of the 20th century. But Jonathan Edwards is indeed the paradigmatic figure for philosophical reflection for the first 200 years. And it's not until Emerson arrives in the early 19th century, who is not a philosopher per se, but more a man of letters, engaged in cultural criticism, social commentary, and societal reform. Where is American philosophy up prior to 1900? We'll get right to Charles Peirce and Dewey and James. And interesting enough, Peirce, Dewey, and James engage in a critique of what philosophy has been conceived of. It's an attempt to eliminate it in a fundamental sense. That's what pragmatism in a way is. Pragmatism is indeed, in a fundamental sense, one of the most revolutionary developments in philosophy itself, because it claims, in a certain sense, philosophy has no subject matter. It becomes reduced to cultural criticism, social commentary. context. Black seems to be contextless. That's kind of sloppy talk after a while, it seems to me, if we want to be historical about this. Now, I would want to claim that when we look at what Professor Jones discerns as Afro-American philosophy, I think that the historical, the very brief historical account that I have given may indeed help explain and expose the very Africanness and Americanness of that choice. The very choice of black religious humanism as the major expression of Afro-American philosophy in and of itself affirms what I'm talking about in the following way. One, that it relates directly to religion, which of course we noted earlier what the African context is concerned with. On the other hand, as we know, within the West, our Western side, our American side that links us with the Greeks and others in the West, Western humanism has produced no commonly recognized great philosophy. Western humanism is primarily concerned with the moral life, civic virtue, and social change. The paradigmatic figure here, of course, is Cicero. It goes down through Petrarch, down through Renaissance humanism, and so on. Let's take a look at, though, this idea of a black religious humanism, then, having affirmed the Africanness and Americanness of this notion. Let's take first the idea of humanism. How does Professor Jones, what does Professor Jones mean by this? What is it? Seems to me to be an extremely slippery term. Can't get our hands on it. The African context related to religion seems to be fairly clear, though once we unpack precisely what African humanism means, that raises a number of questions. I won't go into that, but that to me raises a number of questions. In the Western context, it seems to be a bit more possibility for clarity, and let's take a brief look at that. The very word humanism doesn't appear in the Western until 1490, of course, we're talking about the Renaissance. What indeed was that all about? Well, it was this return to antiquity by appropriating classical letters, which would seemingly produce a rebirth of spirit that human beings had possessed in the classical age and lost in the Middle Ages in the West, as believed by Renaissance humanism. What is this spirit? It's the spirit of freedom. The spirit of freedom which provides justification for man's claim of rational autonomy, making nature and history his realm, mastery over nature and history. Born in Florence, and indeed it is the view put forward by a highly urbanized intelligentsia, was fighting for autonomy, primarily for its patrons, the city leaders, local prince, and so on, against primarily empire, often the church, and a few social structures. Renaissance humanism dies, or is dead by the 16th century, the 20th way. It dies with the waning of Florentine republicanism. And humanism seems to surface here and there, but it's no longer a significant intellectual movement, let alone one that is institutionalized. Here again, trying to just characterize the slipperiness of the term, I think is important. In our day, there's basically four different that put forward some kind of humanism. The first is the pragmatist. This is primarily manifest in the works of F.C.S. Schiller, the British pragmatist philosopher, who wrote a book on humanism, book out the essays and studies in humanism. The other would be Jacques Maritain, the great Catholic, the great French Catholic philosopher, who wrote a book called True Humanism, coming out of the personalist school, very different than Schiller. The third would be Sartre, existentialism, or the later Camus and the rebel coming out of the existentialist tradition. And then, of course, there's Marx, the early Marx, the Economic and Philosophical Manuscript of 1844, coming out of what we claim to be a communist tradition. What I'm trying to characterize here is that humanism is so slippery that all four of these chaps can claim it. And politically, it even gets worse. That Schiller was a fascist. He supported Oswald Mosley. That Sartre is a Marxist. that Camus was an anti-communist liberal, that Marathon's a moderate Thomas, told me, how do we go about discerning what humanism is, if indeed all four claim it in this way? Let's take a look now at the particular adjective in this idea of black religious humanism, and particularly the subject of religious. And I think this is another problem, one that's even more complex and profound than the slipperiness of the term humanism. Professor Jones, like some anthropologists and sociologists of religion, and persons like Robert Bella and Professor Gers come to mind, that he wants to claim that religion is not reducible to the etymology, also to policy, if it has to be considered our policy of freedom. He wants to include non-theism as religious, and he seemingly wants to claim that a whole lot hangs on this. Therefore, a non-theistic humanism can indeed be a religious one. Professor Jones claims, and I quote, that he wants to reduce religion to soteriology, a doctrine of salvation rather than theology. Now, it's this notion of salvation, I think, that we want to focus on. And I think we'll discover that it may be so amorphous that it's not serviceable or useful. I think we can agree with him that many non-theistic theoretical viewpoints contain an ultimate, what I call a salvation program, such as Marx, such as Nietzsche, such as Freud. But I'm not convinced that this definition of religion is helpful. But it seems to me to adopt a view or a definition of religion that entails viewing Marx, Nietzsche, and Freud as religionists obscures rather than clarifies anything. For example, let's use the example of Aristotle. Aristotle of the Metaphysics, primarily Book Lambda and Book Zeta, engages in what we understand to be theology and God talk, with no soteriological aiming whatsoever. If we look at Aristotle just of the Metaphysics, we seemingly have a theologian who's not religious, if you understand religion to be soteriological. That seems counterintuitive. So we can make a claim that he's theological, but not religious. On the other hand, when we look at when Aristotle engages in his soteriology, which indeed he does in other texts, in the Nicomachean Ethics, for example, he makes no appeal to God. That Aristotle's corrective activity, that Aristotle's so-called salvation program, has nothing to do whatsoever with appeals. So in that case, we seemingly have the Aristotle of the Nicomachean Ethics as a non-theistic soteriologist, and Aristotle of the Metaphysics as a theistic non-religious thinker. That's part of the obscurity, I think, in employing these kinds of criteria. The same would hold for the deist during the Enlightenment. The same would hold for somebody like Sir Isaac Newton, where God has no relation to any sociological program whatsoever. He just makes the push and things keep going. And yet, on the other hand, one could claim that Newtonians do indeed have a salvation program in their own way, but it has very little to do with God. God is solely an explanatory factor, and once you perform that function, that's within his spin, as it were. That's part of the problem, I think. And the fundamental question that is raised, of course, is if indeed we understand religion as soteriology, the question becomes, can we ever envision a kind of philosophy, a whole corpus of a thinker, that isn't religious? That is to say, if indeed we have an understanding of religion that's so broad that every philosopher that we can think of can be subsumed under it, how serviceable such a term? That, I would think, is an important question. Now, if what I say has any possibility, it seems to me that it would be useful just to call non-theistic views of Afro-Americans secular and drop the term religion. It's secular, irregardless of how it's arrived at. I agree totally that Afro-American, as you understand Afro-American humanism, even humanism not inverted commas because now it's a slippery term, not really sure what it is. claim, why not call them human? There's nothing wrong with that. This brings me to my last point, namely, how Mr. Jones understands secularism. At one point, I don't think he mentioned it in his writing, in his talk today, but in his writing, he associates humanism with a self-confident perspective. Self-confident perspective. Now, we've seen it in the West. This is quite accurate for Florentine and Renaissance humanism, which had indeed an exceeding confidence in human capacity to master and control nature and history. The big Professor Jones goes on to claim that within the Afro-American context, humanism takes the form of a questioning of God's benevolence, using slave secular devil songs, as we call, and blues as examples. Now, it should be noted there is a huge gap between questioning God's goodness and expounding a self-confident perspective. A whole lot goes on. There's a whole spectrum of positions between questioning God's benevolence and a self-confident perspective that I'm claiming. In the West, in ancient times, questioning God's goodness culminates with the cynic and skepticism. And interesting enough, of course, this doesn't really occur under domination, under Macedonian domination, post-Christian period. In Afro-American experience, such questioning is contained within the blues, devil songs, and slave secularism. But these forms embody precisely a cynicism, a skepticism, and a stoicism. If Professor Jones claims that these forms qualify as humanist expressions, then humanism can be tragic, it can be resignatory, or even nihilistic. It needs to be self-confident. If Professor Jones claims that they don't qualify as humanist expressions, then black non-theistic humanism as a self-confident perspective must be limited to non-theistic liberal and Marxist black thinking.
Oh, yeah.
But that a presidential
take them out of the
or addressed by a bishop talk about them in terms of arguments for God's
large
existence
numbers
and so
forth. Of people
but the, I'm saying that's a truncated
now, therefore, in terms of isolating values and seeing what this thing is all about,
a system where the original
that it's not personal when you hear that kind of event. And therefore, Martin Luther King, I think that you can look at a number of his speeches, and you can, in fact, say that Martin Luther King stands in tradition, because you can point to many, many, many speeches and addresses and so forth done by many other people at different times that have said almost the same sort of thing and the same idea. And therefore, you can say that it's not just King, and he personifies at this point the tradition.
Now, what is the
point? And therefore, I've been wrestling with how do you get at the values of people without sort of doing a sociological analysis. You do need to have a half million dollars in order to run president. But I'm trying to say now, how do you get at that? Well, you really do. Look at the primary institutions.
You
and
say
then
that
look at the, and then that's what I'm doing, and that's what I say in the book.
But
you look at the
leadership,
and then you look at the primary institution. You look at the primary leaders in that institution, and then you say, well, at least you're saying something that makes good sense about giving some direction.
But do you also look at their budget? Do you do anything in terms of their budgets? Because I think if you look at their budgets, you'll get a truer picture of their value than the entertainment side of the village, what they think of.
The one
entertainment value of the preaching. That if in fact, as you say, a lot of the money to do some of those concerns from one phone.
I agree with that. I agree with you. I do not look at their budget. One thing is, it's almost impossible to find the budget of the
Baptist. I might say, in the way of introduction, that's Dr. Bailey, who is
because it negates the necessary category of any
Old Testament.
Testament. Charles wanted to have the wrap up wood and then another one.
I'm going to have to work out because I'm the ranking society officer. I want you to close. I thought it was the appropriate time for us to close this discussion.
All right. Now,
manuscript before it's published.
I
think
it's
a good
introduction.
I'm really being facetious about
it.
I am saying that when I was in the midst of my dissertation,
I know the
major controversy. I had some very I might not sign. I'm saying that we are indebted to Peter for having led us this morning and for this extended time. And I want to say that I'm deeply indebted, and I know I speak for the Board of Trustees of Gammon, who
historic situation
made available the facilities of the part of its resources. To say how happy we are to have had the experience
now, let me
of having
the fact that
in
that
the
and
the dialogue. Those
first,
persons who did
the
form of leadership, who were also members of the society.
In contrast,
you have enriched our lives. And I know I speak on behalf collectively of all of those pastors who have come
from the middle
back.
And
the idea was to have you be in dialogue with them.
Third,
and to have them respond.
The evolution of humanism
in Greek culture, some persons
from
among them also to participate in presenting papers.
Gave it real more the valuable treatment of the black church and its contribution to the radical movement of black thought and practice.
Experience has exceeded my expectations and expectations of the task force on program. We would like to invite you back to the final in these series of conversations we've had three. The first had to do with the role of the boards and agencies of the Methodist Church in strengthening the black church. And my response was not nearly so forceful and forthright as were the responses that had come from this group. This one had to do with the assessment of black theology and its relevancy. I was interested in the
Black
and
Grants
of wrestling with the word relevant, saying that it's that black theology is either relevant or it is futile. And we wrestle with that.
Social, economic
but still.